Lecture 23, Justifying Natural Evil.
Last time we were talking about a line of argument that might be used to claim that the various evils that occur in the world are practically necessary for the achievement of one or another greater good in the long run. In the midst of that conversation, I was talking about evil quite generally and quite broadly. What I want to do this time and next time is to break the evils down into what I will call natural evils on the one hand and human evils on the other hand, and see how far we can get with natural evils and how far we can get with human evils by way of reconciling their occurrence with the existence of the ethical monotheist's God in terms of there being practical necessities for the achievement of greater goods. Now, before I do that, I need to reinforce a point already made. You could, of course, argue that all of the natural evils that occur in the world, and by natural evils I mean things like parasite infestations and tidal waves and earthquakes and rocks that fall out of the sky and so on. You could claim that all of those natural evils ultimately are the result in the long run of things that people have done. And if you could make a convincing case of that, you would essentially be putting all of your eggs in the one basket, that is to say, we'll come up with one good, rousing theodicy that will justify human evils, and then just as a contingent byproduct of that, that will take care of the natural evils that worked their way out of them in the long run, and so on. I frankly, as I've indicated already, don't think that that lumping together of natural and human evils is a very promising path. It may be my own limitations of imagination or understanding that bring me to say that, but from where I stand, at any rate, it is very, very difficult to make a convincing case that all of the natural events that happen in the world that are as horrific as they are somehow the byproducts or the results of things that human beings have done. It simply strikes me as fantastic, fantastic in extreme, to think that in the eras of time before there even were human beings in the world, that there was no suffering, that there was no misery. There are, after all, non-human animals, and there were non-human animals undoubtedly before there were human animals. And if we suffer from parasite infestations, I find it quite remarkable to figure that before we came along, the parasites left the chimpanzees alone, etc. I was saying the other day that this would require a great deal of dental work coincidental with the fall in order to convert a herbivorous population of the globe into a carnivorous population in order to unleash the rule of the jungle, the tooth and claw scenario that is so familiar to us today. So my own strong feeling is that we need to look at natural evils in their own right and see if there is any kind of justificatory move that can be made to say that these natural evils are practically necessary for the achievement of greater goods in and of themselves, not writing them off as the regrettable, lamentable consequences of human wrongdoing. Okay, one way to do that, being very specific now, we've nibbled on the edge of this before, but one way to do that is to simply say the natural evils that occur to people, and I suppose the natural evils that occur to non-human life forms as well, are deserved. When something horrible happens to us, we're getting exactly what we deserve. One label to put on that is punishment. Bear with me here for a moment. If there is a God, and if God is omnipotent and omniscient and all of those things, then no doubt God would have foreseen that we would do bad things from time to time. We'll be talking about free will and its costs shortly. And so God would want to arm himself with a vast arsenal of appropriate methods with which to punish us when we step out of line. And so all kinds of arrows are in God's quiver. And thus you get a kind of a rationale for parasites, and you get a kind of a rationale for tidal waves, and a kind of a rationale for earthquakes. They're just the means that God has chosen to use to give us exactly what we deserve. Now, this line of thought that when a bad thing happens to someone, they're just being paid what they've earned is a very, very common and widespread understanding of the way the world works. And it's a very ancient understanding of how the world works. It isn't something that philosophers dreamed up in the last few years. Go back to what Christians called the Old Testament, or go back to what Jews simply call the book. Go back and read the story of Job. This is what Job is wrestling with. Terrible things are happening in Job's life, and all of his neighbors are pointing at him in derision and saying, "What must you have done, Job, to deserve these terrible things that are happening to you? How far out of line must you have gotten that God is clobbering you with all of these dreadful, dreadful punishments? Your crops are wasted in the fields. Your livestock are sickened and dying. You are beset with plagues and boils and any unpleasant thing you can think of. Boy, you must have really, really committed some big sins that God is paying you back this way." Now, the interesting thing about the book of Job, though, is not that that's what all of his so-called friends believed. The interesting thing to me, at any rate, about the book of Job is that Job didn't buy it for a minute. Job said, that can't be right. That can't be correct. That can't be the right analysis of what's going on, because I haven't done any terrible things. I've been a decent and God-fearing man. There's no way in the world that a God who is fair would be doing these kinds of things to me as punishment, because I just haven't earned that kind of payback. Quick footnote as it goes by. Job, as I'm personifying him here for the moment, might have said something about what you could expect of a God that was fair. Do we have any right to expect God to be fair? Isn't this imputing to God moral standards of our own? I think not, in fact. I think Job would be on quite secure grounds here, because what Job would be saying is, God has got to surpass our moral standards. And if we found that God didn't even live up to the sordid moral standards of the human community, then God would be anything but morally flawless. So God's got to be at least fair. At least. And probably a lot more than that besides. So if Job is arguing, it just what's happening to me isn't fair, so that can't be the right analysis. It just can't be that God is punishing me this way for what I've done, because I haven't done anything to deserve it. So we have an interesting situation here of a very ancient and very widespread, very commonly shared view of how it is that bad things happen, and right along with it, a very ancient and very deeply rooted objection to that analysis that we find right at the heart of the religious literature of the whole Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. You know, Job isn't in the book idly. Job is there because our ancestors and those who made the decisions about what things were going to get included in the book recognized it as a very, very important piece of writing. Recognized it as wrestling with a really fundamental issue that needs to be addressed. Now, the writer of the Job story, whoever it may have been, the writer of the Job story had his own analysis of what was going on, and we'll talk about that in a little while. Essentially, in the Job story, what's going on is Job is being tried and tested. Job is being beset with adversities and difficulties of every kind to prove him out. And that is an interesting, different approach, but nothing to do with punishment at all. Well, there are some things wrong with the punishment analysis as soon as you realize, as many, many ancient writers have realized, that the wind blows wherever it will and the rain falls on the good and the evil alike. There isn't any correlation. In fact, there's a discorrelation frequently. People who have done terrible things seem to live charmed lives. People who have been devout and saintly have lives of extreme hardship and difficulty. It doesn't correlate, it doesn't compute as any kind of clear and straightforward transaction of punishment for wrongdoing. Furthermore, and this is hard to say because it's difficult to say it without possibly being offensive, and my task here is not to try to offend, but terrible, terrible things happen in the world to those whom I would be inclined to say are by definition innocent of any wrongdoing. I'm not going to tell you the whole story because it is too personal and it is too deeply disturbing for me to tell it in this context, but I want to give you a vignette. Some people that I knew, this is some years ago now, very decent folk with a family of several children, had under tragic circumstances a house fire. I'm not making it up. It was on Christmas Eve. Their house burned to the ground, and three of their children were burned to death in their beds. The children were probably at that time along somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 and about 7 or 8 and 2. Now, I'm hard-pressed, very hard-pressed, to think that the 10-year-old was living a secret life of sin, such that being zapped this way was appropriate and earned. I'm even harder-pressed for the younger one. And the infant? What dark thoughts must that infant have had going through its ill-formed mind in its crib to have committed so great a sin as to have been burned alive as just punishment? Again, all I'm saying is it just doesn't compute. Now, the religious tradition has dealt with this, and I have to be fair too. The religious tradition has dealt with this by generating the doctrine of original sin. And the doctrine of original sin says that when Adam and Eve sinned way back there, which presumes that there really was an Adam and Eve, which is another story. But when Adam and Eve sinned way back there in the Garden of Eden, etc., 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 they so catastrophically disrupted God's good order in the world that they brought condemnation to everyone, even those yet unborn, so that we are conceived in iniquity and born in sin from day one. So the two-year-old does not have to have had a lascivious thought in its unformed mind. The two-year-old is being dealt with because the two-year-old's natural destiny, given the doctrine of original sin, is to burn forever anyway. It's just what he deserved. I remember at one time when my own children were preteens, and we were going to a church at the time. I'm not going to identify the denomination. One of the things that that particular church had the preteen youth group working on was a catechism that was specific to the denomination in question. And I was trying to be a good daddy, and I was helping them with their catechism. But we didn't get very far in that catechism before I found myself very alarmed, because it wasn't more than, it was within the first 10 questions in the catechismal routine that the question was asked, what is the natural destiny of man? And the answer right there in black and white was, the natural destiny of man is to burn in hell forever. Now, if you can take that as a given, if you can take it that everyone, no matter how apparently innocent, no matter how young, no matter how unformed, no matter how, to use the politically correct label these days, no matter how challenged, doesn't matter, each and every one of them, their natural destiny is to burn in hell forever. There is no such thing as innocence. If you can buy that, then I suppose that anything that might happen in this world by way of comparison to hellfire and brimstone, anything that might happen in this world or anything that does happen in this world is relatively mild by comparison. It's all deserved. If anything decent happens at all, then we can just be appreciative for the grace that allows us to have it momentarily and be thankful to God in His wisdom that we're not getting what we deserve at that point as well. I think one has to decide at some point whether one is going to give allegiance to a doctrine like the doctrine of original sin, because it has been ratified by a council at some point in history and has declared to be orthodoxy, or whether one is going to give allegiance to the sensibilities of one's perception of the plight of those who are obviously innocent and are being dealt with in this world in an horrendous way. You have to decide where your allegiances are going to go. A historical comment here. That is exactly the point that Leslie Weatherhead was getting at. I've mentioned him before, and I've mentioned his point before, where he talks about the Christian agnostic, the person who wants to commit themselves to a particular religious way of taking the world, but simply cannot in good conscience buy all of the detailed things that the various councils have said you've got to believe. And so one might say, and Leslie Weatherhead would say and did say, no, I do not buy the notion of original sin and eternal damnation and torment. No, I do not buy the notion that every unpleasant thing that happens to anyone, no matter how innocent, is just punishment for their secret sins and the sins of their ancestors. That just doesn't compute for me. I'm going to go at it another way. I think it is important to realize that one can make that move and one can go at it another way, and that does not entail that one is giving up on the enterprise of seeing the world religiously. But it's going to take us some effort and some time to see what seeing the world religiously amounts to if we begin to pare away some of these things that I would call aberrations, such as the universal desert of horrible treatment by each and every one who has ever lived. Furthermore, let's just assume for purposes of discussion for a moment that the natural evils that occur in the world are punishments. Okay, they're punishments. Then I would simply observe that they are frequently very, very heavy-handed. Incredibly heavy-handed. Now, maybe a teenager who misses curfew deserves to be grounded for a week. A preteen who filches candy money out of his mother's pocketbook deserves to not have dessert for so many days. Or, if my grandmother was right, deserved a good thrashing. I could even see that under certain circumstances. But the things that happen to people in the world are not measured. They are not apt. You know, even if we buy the notion that each and every time something happens, it is punishment for something that somebody has done somewhere, sometime, they are extreme, heavy-handed, draconian, appalling. Recall that at one point in the religious writings of the Christian tradition, at any rate, it is said that God loves us as a father loves his children. Now, I grant you that whenever we speak of God, we're told by the theologians we are speaking analogically, and so when we say God loves us as a father loves his children, we don't mean precisely, exactly, by loves in God loves us, what we mean by loves in a father loves his children. But there needs to be some sort of similarity there if the analogy is going to work at all. And I think what one would want to say then is, okay, God loves us as a father loves his children. That means in any way that God's love for us differs from a father's love for his children, it's going to differ by way of being better. God's love for us is going to start with a father's love for his children and get better beyond that up to the infinite and divine kind of level. It's going to have to be at least that. If we knew of a situation where a father who had his children under his control and in a closed environment that was absolutely operating at his direction and without any independent input from the outside whatever, if we knew of a situation where a father had children in that kind of closed environment and was doing to those children and seeing to it that it was done to those children, things that happened standardly in the world day in and day out, we'd have the father arrested. Now, there are fathers who love their children very badly. And it sickens me when I pick up the newspaper and I read the terrible stories of the family that kept their children tied up in the back of a school bus down near Virginia Beach some years ago. Horrible, horrible story. Children kept in cages, children kept in closets, children tortured and tormented. Those are terrible things. And of course we say, those fathers don't love their children. Those fathers are sick and tormented individuals who are treating their children in catastrophically horrible ways, and they ought to be taken up and locked up and somebody throw away the key. And yet, when we see a child starving, infected with sleeping sickness, and other parasitic diseases as well. Any typical child in a tribal situation in West Africa today. And they're dying by the hundreds, day by day by day, in agony. What do we say? God loves them, and God is giving them what they deserve. I just don't think that computes. Finally, I mentioned the other day that perhaps we might take some of this out in the context of examples, making an example of, warnings, that kind of thing. And so I'm not going to take a great deal of time on it now, but it just seems to me warnings are no better handle on horrible things happening to people than outright punishments are. Sure, there is a place. There is a place in the world for teaching techniques. Let me take just a moment on this. You might have a child, and you might say the child is eventually going to have to deal with very, very difficult situations, so I want to give the child some adversity in order to strengthen them and to prepare them for these difficult situations. I want them to be able and flexible and able to take a risk and able to stand up before difficult, adverse circumstances. Sure. And you encourage them to join Outward Bound, or you encourage them to join the Scouts, or you encourage them to do all different kinds of things that will stretch them and help them grow. Of course. But you temper the learning experiences that you provide for them in terms of reasonable expectations of what they can cope with. Of course you do. I remember not too many years ago, a farmer got very, very angry in the western part of Virginia because some of the local children were stealing fruit from his orchard. And so he planted landmines around the boundary of the orchard. He got into severe trouble with courts. They said that was just a little bit overdone, that it would be perfectly all right for him to hang up no trespassing signs. It would be perfectly all right for him to talk to their parents. There are all kinds of things he could do, but you don't hide landmines around your apple trees. And certainly, and I know that this is exaggerated, but I'm just trying to make the point, certainly if I want my child to be able to cope with adversity, I'm not going to arrange in advance for there to be landmines planted at the camp where I send him for the summer. That is giving him more adversity than a child needs to deal with. So again, if we look at the scope and the impact of the negative things that indeed do happen in the world, I don't think they make any better sense as warnings and as object lessons than they do as punishments. Out of all of this, it seems to me, we haven't come up with a very effective theodicy for natural evils. And while at the beginning I would have been tempted to say that pushing the responsibility for natural evils off onto people, off onto autonomy, off onto the price of freedom, was a real stretch, that may be the most promising of the lot. When next we meet, I want to talk with you about a free will theodicy that would take care of some of the bad things that people do. And right along with that, I want to talk to you and with you about another free will theodicy, one that is very unpopular in the 21st century, but a free will theodicy which pushes the responsibility for the rest of it off on the dark side itself, on satanic power.